The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by Exchange Wire.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. Today we have a team episode and I'm pleased to be here with Exchange Wire CEO Rachel Smith. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks very much, Amy. Delighted to be back again. I'm becoming a regular on the podcast.
Yeah, it's good to have you as a regular, though. And John Sill, our head of content. Welcome, John.
Thanks very much. Nice to be back on.
Yeah. And today our stories cover the potential breakup of Google that's on the cards, OpenAI's latest round of funding, and Amazon increasing ad loads for Prime Video. So let's get into the first story, which is from the BBC. The DOJ has threatened Google with what it refers to as structural requirements, basically considering asking a judge to order the breakup of Google's tech empire. It stated this in a court document that was filed this week. So I'll come to you first, Rachel. What is the potential breakup of Google likely to look like?
So this is a really interesting story because it's a High Court judge ruling off the back of the DOJ winning the claim against Google for anti-competition in its search business. So this sort of proposed breakup of Google from the court filings that you shared and that are connected with this news story, Amy, suggests a series of actions which would be obviously focused on anti-competition across their business, but specifically as well within search. And then they've outlined sort of four particular areas. The first is that they want to end Chrome being the default browser on various mobile operating systems. As we all know, the likes of Samsung handsets and even I think it's Apple handsets these days come with Chrome as the default browser. And there's, of course, a sort of a revenue share arrangement there with those handset providers to make that a commercially viable deal. And they want to bring that kind of an arrangement to an end so that Chrome isn't the default browser across everybody's handset. They also want to require Google to start sharing the data that they have access to across every area of their business, which would also have a strong element on any of the AI search functionality that Google is developing at the moment. They want to restrict Google's ability to use information from other sites to train their own AI algorithms. And then they also want to create more competition in search advertising. And then that fourth element, trying to create a scenario where there's more competition in search advertising, then starts to lead into the current ongoing case that the DOJ has put forward against Google for anti-competition and dominance in its advertising stack. Because the fourth requirement of this particular proposed framework under this ruling regarding their search business is suggesting that Google needs to open themselves up to more transparency in the advertising auction so that advertisers understand where their money's being invested and so that they can introduce more competition into search advertising. So that, I think, is the read-across link into the other ruling that's undergoing at the moment, or the other court case that's undergoing at the moment around Google's ad tech stack. So what would a breakup look like? I think lots of predictions that it's far more likely a judge isn't going to require the business to break, to divest of its various sort of sections and various assets. Instead, it would require them to adhere to something like this framework, which is what the DOJ are putting forward as a suggested solution, because... And the reason many commentators think that it's more likely a judge will go down this route than breaking up the entire business is because that's a more complex thing to do. It will be an easier thing to do to try to put in place a legal framework which can be monitored by, you know, government officials and can have a sort of a fine structure associated with it and effectively tiers of compliance. You know, this is the legal framework within which you have to operate regarding your search business, and you can imagine how that could then eventually be rolled out to the ad tech business as well. And so you have to behave in these ways, and regarding search, you specifically have to adhere to these few characteristics. And if you don't, then there'll be action that we can take, which will include a fine and will include, you know, being able to take some other kind of corrective actions to disincentivize Google to go against that legal framework. So I can understand why commentators think that's more likely to happen than a sort of all out, you must divest of these areas of your business. But I also think this is incredibly complex area of law and also a complex area. Well, it just adds to the complexity with which Google structured their business, right? It's not going to be an easy thing to do. So I still think there's lots of debate to be had, both on the legal side, and then also we have to expect, because this ruling isn't expected to be finalised until August 2025. So we've got to anticipate that Google is going to be readying themselves to put in some challenges to any legal ruling that comes down the line, which could further, further lengthen the entire process. So I think there's a lot more debate to be had, and there's a lot more proposals to be put forward to have a look at how this framework could work in the most, in the fairest way possible, not just fair to Google, but also fair to other businesses that, make a lot of money off search and off advertising and, frankly, off mobile phone handsets, etc. There's so many elements to this particular case that I think it's going to be long and complex. So what would a breakup look like? I've got absolutely no idea at this stage because I think the complexity is just too big. And of course, the other obvious question is, therefore, because of the size of the scale of the complexity that they're dealing with, both on a legal side and on the how the business is structured side, could Google decide to act themselves ahead of time before they get forced to do anything? Another big question mark, not sure.
Yeah, it's a very complicated matter and their business could look quite different soon. John, I'll come to you on that note that you just said that, Rachel. John, do you think they could call their own breakup before it's forced on them?
Yeah, I don't know how proactive they'd want to be on that. They're at the moment, they're readying themselves for an appeal by the looks of it. They've described this recommendation as government overreach and discussed higher prices for consumers. They've said that Amazon and TikTok are being turned to, so they're not really, they're not dominating the market, which is nonsense because they have 90% of online search market. They've got more than 50% of the ad market. So they will appeal. The precedent we have is the Microsoft case from the early 2000s, which Microsoft were ordered or set to be ordered to break up, and that was turned around a year later on appeals. So there's a lot of legal wrangling left to go in this case before we know what it could even start to look like. But you would expect, maybe, I don't know how you feel about this one, Rachel, but you'd expect them to take some conciliatory measures in that time, it's a bit of a kind of, okay, we can do this, maybe we'll spin off a certain part of our business, maybe we can do this, maybe we can open up to other platforms. So maybe there'll be some conciliatory action, but I'm not sure really how this will go down, but I'm sure that there is a lengthy hand-wringing and appeal process coming up over the next year or so.
Yeah. I mean, to your question, John, I do think that they'd be mad to not be considering what they could be doing internally themselves at the moment to counteract some of this legal action. That's got to be in the list of, at the weekly kind of CEO briefing meeting, what risks are we facing this week? That's got to be top of the pile, right? Like, how can we reduce
threat?
Exactly. And how can we reduce our legal costs? So, they've got to be looking at that in the round for sure. It's just that once you start to get into the detail of it, even just a summary of the, of the court documents that were made public this week, even just a summary of that really gets your mind thinking about all the other businesses and players that are impacted by some of this activity. Yes, take for example the fact that Chrome is default browser on so many people's handsets. Yes, that is absolutely anti-competitive, but they've got some licensing agreements in place that enable that to happen. How much revenue do those other companies make off those licensing agreements? What impact does that have on their business? Ensuring that Chrome is no longer the default search browser on handsets, does that actually open up to more competition, or does that just cut some revenue streams off at the knees for other businesses and make matters worse? Which of course will be things that Google will be using in their arguments, as you already mentioned, John, trying to say, well, look, there are other search engines out there that are growing in popularity and using other tools and mechanisms to get more people coming to them to search, namely AI, quite frankly, which is what they're busy trying to do with their search business too. So there is an element of this where I feel like when you start to dive into the detail of it a little more and read a little more, especially around the court documentation, I still have that recurring feeling that a lot of this activity is happening after the horse has bolted. You know, it's no really, we should have gotten to grips with some of this complexity 10 years ago at least, and we haven't, and so we're in a bit of a mess at the moment, and it's very difficult therefore to predict exactly what's going to happen next. I mean, you know, the world of predictions is always spurious, but I think it's particularly difficult to predict what's happening with Google and what's going to happen with their business and what it will look like in the next few years because of all of this legal activity, because of the volume of complexity that's associated with it. And also underscoring all of this is that both of those claims that are being put forward at the moment, the one that's been, you know, found in the favour of the DOJ around Google's search business, but also the AdTechStack case, is all about anti-competition. And so the government should be having their anti-competition experts looking at this, crawling all over it, using the Microsoft precedent that was set however many years ago to understand what the full limits of their powers are and to try to truly create some or re-inject some competition into these marketplaces. I fear that that's beginning getting possibly a bit obfuscated by people trying to head down a particular path because they're just annoyed at the size of Google. Understandably so, but this has really got to be done from a structural point of view. And yeah, I just don't know where that's going to lead us. I also wonder, I don't know what you guys both think about this, because Amy, you've written a lot about it over the time that you've been with ExchangeWire, but I'm also starting to wonder if that was where their cookie deprecation decision came from. Is this just all about anti-competition? They are trying to back away from any scenario where they're seen to publicly make a decision about their products or their services that's going to materially benefit them over everybody else.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, I think it could be.
And it's, I think, like the points that you've made on the complexity and how it impacts everyone. I mean, we had our breakup of Google panel at ATS London. We had some, you know, quite differing viewpoints from our panelists. I think a lot of us expected it to be all kind of, hooray, yeah, let's do it. This is the rise of independent ad tech. This is where we really get a foothold. And I think there is some of that. It will open up the market an awful lot if they were to be broken up. But we had someone on the brand side, Danush from QRED, who said, you know, if my car runs on petrol and tomorrow there's no more petrol in the world, then where do I go? How do I go anywhere? And that's how a lot of people are going to be looking at the breakup of Google, with a bit of concern that the infrastructure's, like you said, Rachel, horse bolted. Like, we built on this, we built our foundations on this. And I think there's going to be a lot of concern around what on earth do we do next, despite the, you know, the deluge that could fill the hole and all these great independent ad tech companies. Yeah, I imagine there's so much to think about in this case. It's so interesting
because exactly.
it impacts everything. So
absolutely, it's endless, and it starts me thinking that what's happened is Google has effectively built an infrastructure style business, and at a time when, you know, if you think about when they very first started their business, at a time when no one in the government would have been paying any attention whatsoever because they didn't think of the internet as a piece of public service infrastructure. Well, it is now, and that's what we're trying to do, is protect access to the internet, to protect businesses that rely on internet access and advertising, you know, revenue generated via internet activity, as though this is a piece of public service infrastructure. And if we were to accept that it is, that everybody deserves to have access to the internet and it's as fundamental as having electricity supplied to your house, then should that be in the hands of a massive, big private sector tech conglomerate? Well, no, but how do we restructure that? It's so complex.
Yeah, it's all so interconnected as well, like you were saying. I think it would definitely bring about challenges for other companies.
100%. There's no way it can't.
Definitely. Okay, let's move on to our next story then. So this one is about OpenAI from The Guardian. OpenAI has raised $6.6 billion in funding, equivalent to £5 billion. And this brings the company's value to $157 billion, equivalent to just under £220 billion. And this year, the company had been hurtling towards a big loss of almost $5 billion. So this funding that has been raised will go towards furthering AI research and increasing its computing capacity. So I'll come to you first again, Rachel. How could the potential breakup of Google affect OpenAI, just merging those two stories there a bit?
So I think we've already touched on this a little bit, but my feeling as I was reading these two stories and thinking about that particular question is that this is where the government has to be, the US government's got to be really careful, because anything that they stipulate that Google has to do from an anti-competition point of view concerning AI and concerning, you know, developing any sort of search functionality that's AI powered and fueled is obviously going to have to apply to anybody else that's building a business around those fundamental pillars. So whilst anti-competition is extremely important, you really need to think about how you're restricting businesses or how you're structuring a legal framework within which businesses can operate in order to keep innovating and building these tools and solutions. That's the first point, I think, that has a direct correlation with the breakup of Google, potential breakup of Google on the basis of anti-competition. The second point is maybe a bit more nuanced about how AI tools and LLMs are being accessed by people as they grow in popularity, how those businesses, what those businesses are using as their sources of information to inform and educate their AI language models, and how people are actually accessing those services. So this gets back to the whole, again, I suppose, you know, anything we access on the internet being some kind of infrastructure tool, and who pays for us to access that? So is it something that is, you know, magically paid for by advertising, or is it something that we actually have to pay for at the point of access? So a subscription, a subscription sign up model. And then where is that revenue going, and how are we ensuring that all of that is driving, free to access, accurate, content, basically, and how are those content providers being paid? So that element of it then, I think, speaks to the profitability models for businesses like OpenAI, and all of that connects back into how OpenAI is currently structured, which is that it's a non-profit business with a for-profit subsidiary. And this fundraise is for the business to continue to build, but there is talk of the business being restructured to become a full for-profit business. And if it does that, then what does its future business model and monetization model look like? And how is that structured in the light of anti-competition? So are they making sure that wherever they're getting their information from, those people have become, you know, those businesses are being compensated appropriately for that? And how do they make sure that they're not building a business that is blocking out other other competitors that could be offering a similar product? So, you know, I think direct connections with the Google story, and also massive question marks about how a business like OpenAI will continue to build itself and what it's going to use this money for, because it's a significant amount of money, right? And what's really interesting about the article is it talks about the valuation of OpenAI as a business, which is something in the realms of Uber, enormous valuation, still running as a not-for-profit business, but with a for-profit subsidiary. So I think, again, there's lots of complexity there that needs unpicking.
Yeah, the valuation is huge. And that brings us perfectly to the next question for you, John. Could we potentially be looking at another future monopolist?
Oh, I love this question. I think we could. Obviously AI, it's attracting so much investment at the moment. And we chatted a couple of weeks ago on the podcast with Kirsten Lamore regarding Perplexity and how that's moving into ads and the level of competition in AI at the moment. But it's like, it could be like the early days of the search engine. You know, we used to have Ask Jeeves, we used to have Lycos, we used to have AltaVista. All these things just fell by the wayside and Google gobbled it up, and we've ended up 20 years later where we are, as it ate the competition and became the search engine. And there's like OpenAI is positioning itself to be that for AI. That's such a massive valuation and a huge amount of funding going into that business. I have, aside from the general concerns that Sam Altman does not care about guardrails for what he's creating, which is a massive concern, I think, for everyone. It's interesting to see how they are positioning themselves to really compete with, Google will be working on its AI in the background and they have the head start as the early adopters. But this could be the battle for the next two decades. Could be OpenAI and Google, and depending who else gets a foothold. But we could certainly be seeing the beginning of the next monolith, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I also think that, this is why legislators should really be paying attention to what they're doing at the moment, not just on anti-competition, but on also creating some of those legislative guardrails that that we feel quite confident Sam Altman is busy ignoring. You know, that's exactly why we need to be paying attention to this right now, because I think that's what happened in general internet search activity 20, 25 years ago, is nobody paid any attention at all and just let businesses build themselves because we didn't know what that infrastructure was going to be able to do for us down the line. Now we can imagine it much more clearly. We need to actually have government legislators involved in use and application and monitoring of AI products right now, because otherwise I fear we are really headed for bad times.
Agreed.
Yeah, the way it's working at the moment is like they're, you know, far behind with the legislation always, so.
And that is quite common, you know. Yeah. Innovation happens first, legislation happens afterwards. But I think the pace of innovation has picked up so much in all of our lives in the last sort of, even in the last 5 years, quite frankly, compared with the 10 prior to that. So now more than ever, legislators really need to be on the ball and they really need to be paying attention and they really need to be acting and making fast decisions, which is not what they're known for. So I think we need to pick up the pace of that as well. Otherwise, we're going to have these AI tools and models that are overtaking our lives and, like I said, could be bad times. No one wants that.
Yeah, 100%.
We need an AI legislation tool to speed up the process of legislating AI.
We totally do. We totally do.
That would be perfect. Okay, let's get on to our last story now from the Financial Times, looking at Amazon's decision to increase the number of ads on Prime Video starting from next year. So Amazon's made it clear that it did not see a sharp drop in subscribers following the introduction of ads to Prime Video 8 months ago. And you again first, Rachel, how good or bad is this for advertisers and what could the positives and challenges be from this decision?
I guess more arguably, just on a, just from an economic point of view, you would say that more available advertising space is good news for advertisers. But we all know that it's about quality of advertising rather than volume of advertising. So I think actually what's really important in this story is not just the growing nature of streaming providers' ad-funded models. I think that in and of itself is in general a good news story for advertising because, again, that growth in those ad models isn't necessarily all about volume of advertising but could be about better quality advertising, better technology, driving the quality of that advertising, more effective advertising, you know, more transparency, more competition, all of those things, which I think is good for advertisers and good for the advertising industry in general. But I think what we're seeing is in the race for streaming providers to make more money out of advertising, they're going to get caught up in another race, which is the one to retain volume and continue to grow volume of subscribers. And I think that's deeply connected, not just with ads, but with the quality of the content. So I think they've got a number of things to have their minds on, to have their eyes on at the moment, right? It's not just about, we're going to increase the ad load, so that's going to get us a bit more advertising revenue in. It is, what does the quality of that advertising look like? How are consumers going to receive that experience? And what is going to make them stay on your platform? It's not just going to be the advertising experience or lack thereof, therefore you upgrading to an ad-free experience and paying Amazon more money, but it's also going to be what content can I consume on this platform? And I think all of that is becoming really competitive. One more thing on ad load is that I think we talked about this in the context for years, in the context of linear TV moving to more of an internet and streamed TV experience. Here in the UK, we've got a low tolerance for ads because we've always had a really modest ad load in comparison to the financial models that drove linear TV in the US that accelerated to cable really quickly, hundreds of channels, nothing to watch, masses and masses of ads that you have to pick your way through. This is a market that's got a low tolerance for ads, but as soon as you introduce quality content and as soon as all the other competitors are doing the same thing, you can probably start to increase your ad load and people will just live with it. I don't want it to be like that. I want us to still retain this kind of low ad load, environment, viewing environment. But ultimately, because there's so much competition in streaming at the moment, if the other streamers start to increase their ad load volume, then I think consumers will get used to it. And in the end, what's going to differentiate you from me and how many ads I watch versus how many ads you watch is what I have to pay to, you know, for that experience. So far, what I found really interesting is that Amazon has done the same thing as Netflix. They've just shunted the majority of their users onto an ad-funded model and either given them a saving or told them they need to upgrade if they want to ditch the ads. And actually, as a consumer, from my point of view, it's been a totally fine experience. Low volume ads, good quality ads, I'm happy. But once the balance of that starts to shift, I'm not sure what I'll do. I'll mostly move around for content and also price.
Yeah. Do you think if they increase the ad load too quickly, do you think that might get consumers feeling frustrated?
100%. And then people will start making decisions based on, well, what am I actually watching on Amazon Prime? How essential is it? Am I willing to pay more to get rid of the ads? No. And also the content's not that essential, so I'm just going to cancel my subscription. So that's what they've got to battle against, right? But the same as every other streaming provider. They're all in the same bucket now.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's 8 months since they first introduced them. So what do you think, John?
Yeah, I'm with Rachel on this, and in terms of that, I have not so far really noticed the ads. I use Amazon Prime quite a bit, and it's not been intrusive. I think the first time I saw one, it's like, oh, cool, there's an ad, and it's not mid-roll; it's before the show begins, and it didn't bother me that much. Which is, that's great. And as someone in the ad industry, it's interesting for me to see what they're doing. But there's like a fine line, I think, as you alluded to, Rachel, that they have to walk here, because it is a very, very competitive market, and they can't really afford to be pissing their customers off by recreating, or worsening the linear model of advertising, having six ads in the middle of a show, having, sometimes four of the same ad in the middle of a show on some of the platform's early days. I know that's being ironed out now, but it's, they have to be careful about how they up their load, I think, because people might start to notice and take their money elsewhere. I do think that Amazon are in a position of strength with that, though, because Prime is like it's an add-on with a Prime subscription for next day delivery, as much as it is a streaming service on its own right. And they won't lose customers as quickly as a pure play streaming service might in terms of overloading their customers, because you just have Prime because you want your package the next day rather than because you're using it to watch whatever their latest show is that comes out, Rings of Power, whatever it might be. So Amazon maybe need to be, they still need to be careful, but they don't have to show quite as much caution as maybe Netflix or, Disney Plus, or especially stuff like Paramount Plus needs to be when they are looking at how many ads they can serve their consumers before it annoys them that they're paying £9 a month to see loads of ads.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. I hadn't thought about it that way, and I think you're right, John. There's lots of other reasons that you're an Amazon Prime member and that you persist with the subscription. But then I start to think to myself, I guess it comes down to how the business model stacks up. So how much revenue are they making from subscribers versus advertising revenue? I imagine their advertising revenue is enormous, but I know they've got a lot of subscribers as well, but how are they balancing those things out versus the cost of what it takes for them to be able to get things to you the next day and to continue to sustain that volume of next day delivery, etc. So there are some complexities baked into that too. I also think it's really interesting watching what the other, I would call them on the fringes, streaming providers are doing, like Paramount Plus. I've just recently subscribed to Now just for a particular series that I want to watch, and I'm busy powering through it so that I can cancel the subscription in a month's time. Because there's no way I'm going to pay £9 a month for another subscription. I already subscribed to Netflix. So that's another thing, is that the other barrier that they're all going to come up against is there's only so much content that you can watch. We can't create more hours in the day. yes, you can expand your content consumption as much as there are hours in the day, but that's it. And we're probably already all at max content consumption. So people will still be making choices in the way that they did with linear TV. I'm going to watch that and not that. I'm going to be tuning into that channel and not that channel. The main difference is that we have to subscribe to access any of these streaming platforms. And I think people will vote with their feet. You know, if they're not getting the value for money in terms of what they want to watch, then they'll go elsewhere.
Yeah, there's definitely limited time for consumers. But yeah, Amazon's in a great position at the moment. They've got such a big offering. So
Yeah,
we had a CTV panel at ATS London, and Justin Taylor from Teeds made a very interesting point regarding that we spend more time with streams than ever and less time with content because we spend so much time looking for it across the different platforms and people are on the services, but it takes a long time to choose. Anyway, that's just an aside that I just remembered. So just a little thing that made me, that piqued my interest.
Okay, I think that's a good place to wrap up the discussion. Thanks, Rachel and John, for joining me.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, and thanks to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.